Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The state's highest court rules that local court officers cannot detain immigrants based on requests from the federal government.
There is no legal authority for enforcement of civil immigration laws by state officials.
We'll unpack the ruling and examine what impact it has on the debate over sanctuary cities. Also today, a conversation with the new head of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. She's worked on the corporate side of sustainability issues. We'll hear her vision for making businesses a better partner in environmental protection. Plus, it's Judd Apatow Day in Boston. We'll listen to his reading of a modern love essay, At the Hospital, an Interlude of Clarity.
There's never a good time to fall off your couch onto a martini glass, nick a major blood vessel, and begin losing a dangerous amount of blood. But having this happen in the middle of a promising date is an especially bad time.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with big immigration news from the state's highest court. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts has ruled that state court officers can no longer honor federal requests to hold immigrants for up to 48 hours after their criminal cases are over. The ruling is a blow to U.S. and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who have asked local law enforcement to detain immigrants, a request that the SJC says amounts to an unlawful arrest. In its ruling, the court said today it could not identify, quote, a single Massachusetts statute that authorizes a Massachusetts police officer or court officer directly or indirectly to arrest in the circumstances here based on a federal civil immigration detainer. Well, WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling is on this story, and she's with us now. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
So, first of all, this case is called Lunn versus the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Remind us of the background. What happened to Lunn?
Sure. So Shreinuan Lunn was facing larceny charges back in February. The charges were dropped in municipal court, and at that point, he was otherwise free to go. But the court held him on what you mentioned above is called an ICE detainer. And so basically, that's something that follows someone around the court in his or her file. So immigration officials had filed this pretty common request that Lunn be held in custody for up to 48 hours while they try to look into his immigration status, whether or not he can be deported. And the legality of that 48-hour custody is what was at question in this SJC decision. And so whether local court officers and law enforcement have the authority to hold someone based solely on that ICE request.
Okay, so this is obviously a point of extreme contention between local authorities, the state, federal government. So what is the big takeaway from today's ruling?
Well, the headline is really that the answer is no. Local law enforcement and officers cannot hold people who otherwise would be free to go just because federal immigration officials have asked them to keep those people in custody. The court ruled that Massachusetts law simply does not authorize that. And I think it's important to note here the distinction between ICE detainers and criminal warrants. Mm-hmm. That's a key point for the SJC in this decision. These detainers are requests from immigration officials. They are not criminal warrants. There's no probable cause involved in these. It's a civil request. And remember, Lunn was actually free to go after those larceny charges were dropped, but ICE asked that he be kept in custody. According to the SJC, that is not legal in Massachusetts.
Okay, so what's the federal government's reaction to this? I mean, ICE detainers have, those requests have been made for quite some time. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, of course, has actually called them a very important public safety tool.
That's right. He has. And we've reached out to local ICE officials and haven't received an official statement in response. But you're right. Sessions has said that ICE detainers are common practice and fundamental to keeping communities safe. But Emma Winger, one of the attorneys who represented Lunn before the SJC, says that public safety argument is problematic.
Detainers only apply to folks who have, for example, been found not guilty, or their case has been dismissed, or a judge has determined that they should be released on bail. So this case doesn't in any way threaten, you know, the public safety of Massachusetts residents.
So essentially, Winger goes on to say that, for instance, someone who's in custody for a serious or violent crime would continue to be held on those criminal grounds, wouldn't be released, whether or not there's an ICE detainer.
I see. So what's the reaction then been from immigrant rights activists? And by the way, and from local law enforcement
right,
as well.
Right. We've reached out to a number of folks. And as you can imagine, the activist community is applauding this decision. And they're saying that it's actually good for public safety, that it sends a welcoming message to immigrants that they might be more trusting of local police at this point. But representatives from the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Coalition, MIRA, and the Massachusetts chapter of the ACLU both contend that the legislature should still push forward with this Safe Communities Act, right? You'll remember that's before the legislature right now. That's a big politically charged piece of legislation. A big part of it revolves around limiting cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration officials. Uh-huh. So some people had been saying that they were waiting for this Lund decision to come down to sort of reevaluate what the Safe Communities Act should look like. So many people in the activist community are saying this decision is a step in the right direction as far as they're concerned, but more needs to be done. As far as law enforcement is concerned, we did speak with Chelsea Chief of Police Brian Kies. He says he welcomes the much needed clarity and direction from the SJC. And here he is explaining how he passed along further guidance to his department after reading the Lund decision.
In the event that we do receive an ICE detainer, which right now we've been getting at least one a week, if not two a week, and I said if we do get an ICE detainer, the detainer will be filed with the person at the arrestee's file, their folder that goes over to the court. But in the event that the individual is in fact bailed and we do receive a detainer, the individual is going to be bailed.
The individual is going to be released, meaning
not detained. Yeah.
Correct. If the person is free to go, whether they're released on bail, charges are dropped, a sentence is served, that person can no longer continue to be held at the request of ICE in the state of Massachusetts.
Well, that's WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling bringing us up to speed on today's big decision from the SJC about ICE detainers in Massachusetts. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's dive into the legal details here a little further with WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, it's good to have you.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so I have a lot of sort of niggly questions here, but first, let me just get your big take on this. How significant is the SJC's ruling today?
I think this is an extraordinary decision because it really is clarifying an area of the law that never gets clarified. And why is that? Because as in this case, Mr. Lund was in fact released to immigration custody without anyone examining the legality of it and was gone by the time the SJC had to deal with the issue. So the SJC chose to evaluate these claims even though Mr. Lund was gone, was probably deported, because it was an issue that recurs but evades review. So, in other words, they grabbed this even though it was moot as to this individual, which makes it very significant. That's part of the problem of litigating immigration claims. The detainee is gone before you can really come to grips with it.
Right. So Judge Gertner, okay, so a couple small details for clarification here. Is the SJC today saying that no local law enforcement officer or court officer in the state of Massachusetts now can detain an immigrant based on a ICE detainer request, that it just cannot happen in Massachusetts anymore?
Right, because it's saying holding such a person, bear in mind these are civil detainers. These are not allegations of a crime.
Correct.
They're not sort of any kind of arrest warrant in connection with a crime. You could be here you can wind up with an ICE detainer because you overstayed your visa.
Right. These are based on immigration issues, which are civil issues.
The technicalities of immigration issues.
And well, that's so what the court is saying, right? That local law enforcement doesn't actually have the authority to make arrests for civil reasons.
That's right. I mean, because they characterize it as an arrest. It's not just a request, thank you very much. It is you've actually seized the body of the person and haven't let them go. Before you can arrest someone, there has to be statutory authority, and there's no statutory authority. There's no statute that allows that arrest. There's no common law that allows that arrest, federal or state.
And is the SJC then also saying that this decision applies at any point or any touch point that an immigrant might have with local law enforcement. And let me clarify my question here, because, you know, there was quite a bit of concern during the ongoing debate over sanctuary cities. Immigration advocates are saying that, you know, there is the possibility that an immigrant might be arrested for, I don't know, a smaller infraction. And even before they're charged or their criminal proceedings are ongoing, whatever, early on in the process, that's a point at which that federal immigration authorities could issue the detainer request.
Right. I mean, what happens is that once you get into the federal immigration proceeding, someone's rights are different, someone's appellate review are different, access to counsel is different. And so it is a big deal if you wind up being swept into that system. And what this is saying is that state authorities can't hand these people over without, you know, just on the basis of a request, even an administrative warrant, by the way, which is a special category, unless the legislature authorizes it, unless federal or state legislatures authorize this, and the federal legislature authorizing it would have some other problems with it. But certainly until the state legislature steps up to the plate and agrees that these, you know, that there can be enforcement of it, it can't happen.
Right.
If the state stepped up to the plate, I might add, there may be other issues. It could be constitutional issues. We typically don't seize people on civil warrants.
Mm-hmm.
We typically don't. There are some exceptions, but they're rare.
So, Judge Gertner, let me ask you. I mean, Shannon touched on this a little earlier about the Safe Communities Act. What impact does this ruling have on the debate over sanctuary cities in Massachusetts? Because many of the municipalities who claim that they are sanctuary cities, they did so on the basis of saying, you know, local law enforcement was not going to ask an immigrant about their immigration status if they were arrested, and, you know, they wouldn't comply with ICE detainers. That got a lot of pushback from the federal government. So is the SJC essentially saying that sanctuary cities are legal and municipalities are not breaking the law in Massachusetts?
Well, to the sanctuary cities, you know, can cover a whole host of conduct. I mean, on the one hand, a sanctuary city that says we will not respect an immigration detainer, a federal immigration detainer, we will not seize someone based on that, is in fact acting consistently with this decision.
Mm.
Notification issues are different.
Mm.
There's a statute that federal statute that in fact encourages cities and towns to notify, and you can decline notification as well. But this decision is only dealing with seizing the person, only dealing with holding the person. I can't really emphasize how important this decision is. I mean, we don't allow government officials to seize people and arrest them, not for an hour, not for 2 hours, not for days, unless there is proper authorization and it complies with the Constitution. This court is saying there wasn't proper authorization.
So is it reading too much into it to say that the court is going so far as to say that it is conferring certain rights on non-U.S. citizens that weren't enumerated before?
Well, it's not it in part. I mean, they're saying they have a right not to be treated in a lawless fashion, right? If there's no authority for this under the federal under a state statute, then it doesn't matter whether they're illegally in this country. People who are in this country can't be arrested, can't be detained without unless there's authorization in the law. It's not necessarily conferring rights apart from the notion of saying you can't be seized unless there's a statutory authorization. Characterizing this as body of rights really plays into a larger debate. You just cannot be detained. That's all they're saying. You can't be detained simply on the strength of a request, which is all this is, of the federal authorities.
Mm.
And it is remarkable. Let me say the other remarkable thing about this decision, not only that these cases rarely get reviewed, this is unanimous. If you look, this is a decision by the court, unsigned, which means that all judges, all seven judges agreed. That's really quite extraordinary.
Hmm. Well, so the SJC agrees unanimously, but could this issue be appealed into the federal court system and to the Supreme Court?
It can't at all, because the Supreme Judicial Court's decision was based on the absence of a state statute authorizing this. And in the absence of a state statute, there is no further appeal. They are the final arbiters of what the state law requires. If they had decided that it was unconstitutional under the federal constitution, then there would have been an application for certiorari to the Supreme Court. But the way they decided this, which was solely on the basis of the absence of state authorization, that's it.
I see.
There's no further review.
Well, I mean, in fact, the court in its decision wrote that, quote, the prudent course is not for this court to create and attempt to define some new authority for court officers to arrest. The better course is for us to defer to the legislature to establish and carefully define that authority if the legislature wishes that to be the law of this commonwealth. So it seems as if they're putting now the ball in on Beacon Hills Court and saying, if you don't like this ruling, change the law.
Right, and Beacon Hills Court and Beacon Hill could do something that arguably violates the Constitution. So there's a number of rounds left. One is the legislature, and then would be conceivably, depending on the breadth of that kind of statute, a constitutional challenge. But this is really, I would bet that if you go across the country, the numbers of states that have dealt explicitly with this, rather than simply ceding as a voluntary matter to federal authority, are probably quite high.
Hmm.
And so although this is a decision that only affects Massachusetts, only binds Massachusetts, I would imagine that it would be a model for other state Supreme Courts as well.
Interesting. Well, that's WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thank you so very much as always.
You're welcome. Take care.
And by the way, you can hear more about this ruling and what it means for Massachusetts this afternoon on All Things Considered. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A major environmental advocacy organization in Massachusetts is getting new leadership. Elizabeth Turnbull Henry is the new president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. She's got a master's in business administration and environmental management from Yale. By the way, when she was at Yale, she lived in a tiny house that she built herself. And for the past 6 years, she's been the head of energy and climate programs at Adidas. But now, as ELM president, she's moving from the world of corporate sustainability to political and regulatory advocacy. Elizabeth Turnbull Henry joins us now in the studio to talk about that transition and her plans for the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
It's really great to have you. Before we get to sort of the policy stuff, I'd love to actually just get to know you better. I understand that you grew up in West Virginia and you've got some coal connections.
I do, yeah. I grew up in West Virginia in Charleston. And my father, who I love, actually just retired 2 weeks ago from 37 years in the coal industry. And, you know, I love my dad. I think he taught me a lot. And I think he'll make me a better advocate. He and I both believe that energy is the cornerstone to the modern economy, and when it's unreliable, economic development is hard. When it's expensive, it hurts the most vulnerable. And it's generally better to make it here,
yeah,
right, rather than to import it, particularly from places that don't like us.
Well, so let me ask you, I suppose one of the first questions popping into people's mind then is, how does someone, what was your journey from being the daughter of someone who worked in the coal industry to being an advocate for environmental sustainability? How'd you make that path?
Yeah, well, I went to Colby College right up in Maine and had a wonderful experience in an environmental econ class with Tom Teitenberg, who's one of the fathers of environmental econ. And he helped me understand the incredible power of economics to solve some of our environmental problems. Mm-hmm. And also helped me see that this, what has been historically the setup between business v. environmentalists.
Right, an adversarial setup.
Exactly, is pretty outdated. I think businesses have the potential to lead the conversation in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
They are the employers. And in Massachusetts, for example, I think one of our great stories is the cleanup of the Boston Harbor,
right,
where here you have this explosion of economic development that is unleashed when we steward our waterfront, mm-hmm, and natural resources.
Well, so going back to your childhood and growing up in West Virginia, was the environment ever a dinner table subject? Or
Well, yeah. I mean, I think everyone in the state is, for example, when you fly into the Charleston Yeager Airport, it's actually built on an old MTR, mountaintop removal mine site. Yeah. And so flying over southern West Virginia, the whole landscape is green and brown and black. And so everyone is living with the sort of the realities of, you know, this is where energy comes from. And America's a great nation in large part because of our history with these fossil fuels. And so I think the idea that there is an easy way to transition away from fossil fuels is false. I don't know if I'm not answering your question very well.
No, you're doing a good job. The reason why I asked is because it has to do with what you said a minute ago about how traditionally, in its most simplistic terms, there's been the trope has been, you know, environmental advocacy versus business, versus corporation, versus industry, right? There's been an adversarial mentality. But it's interesting that your sort of growing up and family experience, along with, you know, the education that you were talking about as an undergrad and a graduate student at Yale, seems to sort of break that adversarial trope down, right? Like it doesn't have, it's more complicated than that, right? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it is more complicated. And I think businesses acting in their enlightened self-interest see that we need clean air and clean water and see that climate change is real and that we need to get ahead of it. At Adidas, for example, I love my time there. I was there for over 6 years. Yeah. I ran our climate or our carbon reduction investment fund. And one of the things that I loved doing was delivering really high rates of return on sensible energy efficiency, renewable energy, other carbon reduction projects. In fact, we delivered a higher rate of return on carbon reduction than we did on our core business of selling sneakers and, and soccer balls. And so I think this story that, oh, it's always going to cost more to take care of the planet, oh, it's always, is actually not always true. In fact, there's remarkable business opportunities. Massachusetts, as you may know, has 100,000 jobs in clean tech. Mm-hmm. And wind technician is the fastest growing job in the country. I mean, I think that there are tremendous opportunities for Massachusetts to lead the nation, and there's tremendous economic opportunities for us to do so.
So tell me a little bit more about what you did while at Adidas, in terms of maybe lessons learned in how to talk to in how advocates, environmental advocates, need to talk to business in order to be, you know, most effective in their advocacy.
Yeah. So one of my instructive experiences in 2014, we were working to do a ground mount solar project in Walpole, Massachusetts. It's using the virtual net metering program. And, you know, 2.7 megawatts is not certainly utility scale, but it's not small. And it was a great project. It had reasonably strong economics and it leveraged the solar net metering program. So I used a lot of my own, you know, personal and political capital with inside the company, and we got it all the way up the chain, all the way up to our CFO. And he said, all right, let's do it. We've never done anything like this before, but let's do it. And so I turned around back to our developer and said, look, we got this done. And he said, I'm sorry, we've hit the solar net metering cap. We can't do any more solar projects in the state. And it was really heartbreaking and really frustrating. Mm-hmm. And it made me see, I remember lying awake that night thinking, does the government have any idea of how disruptive and destructive it is when you have these really volatile policies to, you know, where incentives are there one month and then they're not there the next month. So I see part of this thesis I have that Massachusetts can and should lead the nation in environmental quality and innovative policy is that we need to have a progressive but stable regulatory environment so that businesses can do what they do best, which is look long-term and make investment decisions accordingly.
So that's one of your sort of priorities as you take the helm for the Environmental League of Massachusetts?
So ELM has this great corporate council of 23 corporations from around the state, and raising their voices on issues that they care about is definitely a priority.
Yeah. So I'm curious about how you're, I mean, you're just at the very beginning here.
Right, first day of the third week. Here we go.
I'll acknowledge that. But the environmental league of Massachusetts over the past couple of years has really amped up its political advocacy. I mean, for example, it was just a couple of years ago, 2015, I believe, where they set up a super PAC, actually, to become a more effective player in state politics. And also the group also began publishing an annual list of Dirty Dozen lawmakers. Right. I mean, so there's some very pointed advocacy that the group has been doing for a couple of years now, which, you know, depending on your perspective, has been effective. I mean, is that something that you would like to see ELM continue?
Oh, definitely. I think the PAC has tremendous potential. We aspire to support environmental candidates when they run and then hold all leaders accountable to the pledges that they made and to make their voting records visible and transparent. That legislative scorecard you mentioned gets a lot of attention. In fact, we were just in a meeting this morning and it came up several times. So it's clearly something that people on Beacon Hill are paying attention to, and I think that's great.
Yeah. So you're taking the place of George Bacharach. He's now officially former president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Great guy. We've had him on the show quite often, but definitely hard charging. He was unafraid to put forth his opinions and criticisms of, you know, a variety of sectors and policymakers in Massachusetts. And I saw he still to this day has some very pointed words about the state's leading industrial or business advocacy group, the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, because George told the State House News Service this. He said, AIM has been the dominant voice on Beacon Hill representing business. And I think this is George Bacharach speaking. An extraordinary leader for the 20th century. The problem is we're in the 21st century and they're living in the wrong century. You can't have it both ways. You can't talk about leading the innovation economy if you can't innovate, and they don't. That's what George Bacharach said. Is that the same sort of posture the Environmental League of Massachusetts is going to have under your leadership?
It's a good question. I have a tremendous amount of respect for George, and he's been a wonderful mentor during this transition. You know, we bring different skills and perspectives to the table. I think one thing that George and I share is this idea that that the messenger matters as much as the message. And so unconventional voices that are sort of typically seen as unconventional really can be heard in new and important ways, yeah, particularly at the State House. Yeah. So if you have businesses talking about how much they value meeting their 100% renewable energy goals, which so many of our businesses in Massachusetts have, then, you know, that's heard in a different way than if you just have the sort of standard chorus of environmental advocates saying renewable energy is important.
Very good point. But I also wonder what your answer would be or your response would be to some folks who say, well, if you look at the federal level right now with the EPA, whenever, you know, under Administrator Scott Pruitt, whenever they hear, you know, bringing business to the table in a more meaningful way, they, in their view, that means rolling back of environmental regulations. And, that, you know, perhaps they may be concerned that could the same thing happen here in Massachusetts if you have business more closely involved or a more significant part of the conversation?
I mean, I guess it depends on the issue. But I think the way in which, you know, our theory of change, the way in which ELM is going to be operating is to be bringing businesses as fellow advocates and also helping us to make the regulations better. So I don't see this as a giant watering down of ELM. I think that they've been the tip of the spear, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah. Just to paraphrase George Bacharach again, an approach for the 21st century,
exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly.
Well, Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry, she's the new president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to having you back frequently on the show.
Thanks, Magna.
All right, well, let's stick with another environment and sustainability story here for just a second, because there's a new type of ultra-energy efficient construction, and it's beginning to take off in New England. It's called passive housing. And these new homes are so energy efficient that they need no central heating at all. Reporter Fred Bever tells us about some early projects in Boston and in Portland, Maine.
imported from Germany, residences built to achieve ultra-low energy use. It's been kind of a boutique-y thing here until recently. But now, New England is joining a surge in large-scale passive housing development. The Bayside Anchor, a big, green, somewhat boxy-looking four-story building that overlooks a tidal cove in Portland, Maine, has joined the trend.
Brand new from the ground up. This was a parking lot.
Architect Jesse Thompson says the 45-unit project had to meet a lot of goals. Construction had to be cost-effective enough to get financed by public and affordable housing groups. It needed common areas. It had to be ultra, ultra efficient. And finally, it had to meet the needs of tenants like Peter Janes, who was one of the first to move in last winter.
I know it has great insulation. I had to shut off my heat. February? It was too hot.
The building does have great insulation. Thompson says the exterior walls are several inches thicker than basic code would require.
Recycled newsprint. It's 10 inches thick, you know, really well done. And there's triple glazed windows. So you can sit next to the window in the middle of winter in a t-shirt and you won't be cold. And that allows us to really radically downsize the heating system.
There isn't a central heating system at all. Instead, each apartment has a small baseboard electric heater with an estimated electricity cost of just $125 a year. It takes more than thick walls to achieve those energy savings. It also takes a near-perfect seal on the building's envelope and a high-tech ventilation system to purge moisture while keeping warm or cool air in, depending on the season. Thompson calls it the building's lungs.
So all the bad air, all the bad smells go out, but the heat stays in. The fancy technical name is a heat recovery ventilator, but they feel like magic to us.
There are other environmentally friendly features, a roof full of solar panels, and underneath the ground floor's polished concrete slab. Instead of a basement crammed with heating systems, big retention tanks allow rainwater to filter slowly into surrounding land, bypassing the city's overworked stormwater system, and offer a cost that's low for Portland's go-go development scene. Thompson says prices for high-efficiency materials and systems are dropping fast. And, he says, public housing agencies are beginning to embrace the long-term savings gain through lower energy and maintenance costs.
Everyone's starting to see how the economics are working. They're giving extra points for meeting these energy goals. So we're going to see a big wave coming in the next 5 years.
It's reached South Boston now.
I don't want to be embarrassing about this, but it's a kind of miracle.
There, on the site of a 19th-century waterfront rum distillery, developer Fred Gordon is renting up the first apartments in what will eventually be a 65-unit passive housing building, very much like the one in Portland. Super tight envelope, high-tech ventilation, and no central heating system. But there's also an important difference. In this case, Gordon isn't relying on government incentives for affordable housing. He's going market rate and plans eventually to sell the units.
It's getting to the point as an investment decision, increasingly attractive.
In Southie's hot housing market, Gordon's got one advantage. He bought an entire city block there back in 1984 when land was considerably cheaper. But he insists that the distillery project proves any developer can radically reduce a building's carbon output and still make a buck. Gordon says renters and buyers are willing to pay a 10 or 15% premium for passive housing features.
We want to make it so that if a building is not a passive house, then people say, oh, well, that's a real negative.
Officials at the Chicago-based Passive Housing Institute say it's still a big ask to finance market-rate units that won't realize full energy efficiency savings for decades. But momentum for large-scale passive housing really did start gaining last year when the number of buildings the institute certified doubled. And that number is on course to more than double again this year, with projects getting bigger and bigger, including a 350-unit New York City high-rise.
That story from reporter Fred Bever. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All right, so I've got some good news and some bad news. The good news is that since Boston Mayor Marty Walsh designated today as Judd Apatow Day in the city, what better guest to have on the show than Judd Apatow? He's the writer, director, and comic who brought us films including Trainwreck, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and most recently The Big Sick. But the bad news? Apatow's flight from New York was canceled, so instead of having a delightful conversation in our warm and dry studios right now, Judd Apatow is stuck in a car driving from New York to Boston, where tonight he's performing stand-up at the Wilbur Theater. So, Judd, if you are close enough to hear this, we are happy to have you on the show anytime in the future. All right, but listeners, wait. I know you are probably just groaning with disappointment right now that I cannot offer you a live conversation with Judd Apatow, but I have a peace offering. You are about to hear from him anyway, because in addition to hosting Radio Boston, I also happen to host what I think is one of the best podcasts out there, Modern Love, the podcast, which WBUR produces with the New York Times. Every week, we take a Modern Love column from the Times and someone famous reads it, bringing it to life in a whole new way. And it just so happens, Judd Apatow has been one of those readers. He read Brian Gittes' essay for us. It is a comical, romantic nightmare, really, titled At the Hospital, An Interlude of Clarity. And here it is.
There's never a good time to fall off your couch onto a martini glass, nick a major blood vessel, and begin losing a dangerous amount of blood. But having this happen in the middle of a promising date is an especially bad time. I demonstrated this last spring while on my fourth date with a Brazilian woman so beautiful I was almost afraid of her. After dinner in a homey Italian restaurant, we walked back to the apartment I had just moved into in Brooklyn. Living in the city for the first time without roommates, I was eager to take advantage of my newfound privacy, and things were going well. There's something romantic about drinking from fancy glasses in an unfurnished room full of unpacked boxes, Miles Davis's In a Silent Way spun on the record player. I was amazed to have gotten this far. As my friends were sick of hearing, it made no sense to me that a gorgeous woman in her early 20s who spoke four languages and had lived on three continents was spending her Saturdays with me, a 31-year-old bookish type from Pittsburgh. Each outing felt as if I were sneaking into an exclusive club, and at the end of the night, I always feared I would be discovered and asked to leave. I realized that meeting someone wonderful is the whole point of dating, but actually being with someone wonderful can be too stressful for me to enjoy. This stress is typical for me. I've been on anti-anxiety medication for about 10 years, and on dates I'm consistently asking myself, was that the wrong thing to say? Do I seem nervous? Will obsessing about being nervous make me appear more nervous? Not unusual questions to ask yourself when meeting new people, but for me they can be paralyzing. Even if the evening goes well, I often appreciate it only later and from a distance, as if it had happened to someone else, like dating in the third person. So far, my success with this particular woman had been an exercise in ignoring the reality of it, which apparently also led me to ignore the reality of my surroundings in general. As she unraveled herself from our embrace on the couch to use the bathroom, I fell onto the after-dinner drink she had left on the floor, the glass slicing into the soft underside of my upper arm. When I looked down, I glimpsed my exposed triceps and more blood than I had ever seen in my life. The cut had gone nearly to the bone. This is not the first time a date ended with me in the emergency room. I seem to have a knack for it. My college girlfriend once served undercooked chicken that gave me hallucinations and a fever of 104. Years later, my attempt to cook breakfast for another woman ended in second-degree burns after I managed to set fire to a paper towel. But the severity of this injury, its unfortunate timing, and the fact that I was naked, all broke new ground. In the ambulance, the emergency medical workers held together my arm, but their questions threatened to unravel my subterfuge as an acceptable mate to this accomplished young woman. "How old are you?" one asked, which put our substantial age difference, something we had not yet talked about, suddenly under a spotlight. "Are you on any medication?" "Antidepressants and Klonopin," I reluctantly answered. Then to her, "Is he your boyfriend? Your friend?" Long pause. "Boyfriend," she blurted uncomfortably. Then an instant later, "Friend." Even though I was riding in an ambulance to surgery, that one still stung. To the entertainment of the hospital's overnight staff, I was still half-naked when I arrived. My date had managed to get pants on me while we waited for the ambulance, But as I hadn't been able to let go of my arm at the time, my shirt would go on only halfway. Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury. The next hour was a chaotic blur of x-rays, questions I struggled not to panic about. Why does this waiver form ask for my religious preference? When I asked, I'm not going to lose my arm, am I? The answer was a troubling, I don't think so. Physical humiliation was next on the agenda. Before the operation, my date got to watch a nurse move my pasty, fluorescent-lit body out of my bloody jeans and into a hospital gown. I pictured us sitting at dinner a week from now, this unflattering snapshot of me hovering between us as I pointed at what I wanted on the menu to the waiter with my hook arm. Then it was time. I remember that the lights in the operating room were very bright, and I remember being told they were about to start the anesthesia. And suddenly, oblivion. I woke in a haze. My arm and my date were both still with me. The operation had gone well, but protocol required me to stay in the emergency room for 6 more hours. This registered briefly as a terrifying amount of time for a woman and me to be left alone with no dim lighting, no alcohol, no movie to watch or appetizers to eat, and no escape hatch in the event of awkwardness. I'll never know if my calm was psychological, a cocktail of adrenaline, morphine, and utter relief, or physiological. After 6 hours of unbroken embarrassment and fear, I was simply too exhausted. Whatever the reason, I felt fine. My date's eyes stared into mine with an uncomplicated tenderness that made my head swim. This, I thought, is what it's like to be with this woman. Neither of us had changed, but I was in a different world. Those 6 hours sailed by gloriously. We traded hospital stories and endless jokes about martini glasses. We talked about books and our families. We came up with an absurd screenplay idea, a horror movie set in a hospital. I was talking and laughing and effortlessly connecting with one of the most beautiful women I had ever seen. A woman I was truly falling for. When I was finally released, our mid-morning cab ride back to my neighborhood felt like a lucid dream. We ate egg sandwiches in the park and returned to find the familiar surroundings of my living room splattered with blood. Through a haze of sleep deprivation and residual morphine, I felt like a ghost returning to the scene of my own murder. As we stood there, mopping up bloody footprints with our Swiffers, surrounded by wadded up pink paper towels, I thought, either you will never see this woman again, or she will stick around a long time. Neither happened. I would like to be able to say my story ends in an epiphany, with the end of my anxiety and the beginning of an enduring relationship. But the reality is, she left me about a month later. Not because she found me repulsive in the fluorescent light of the hospital, but for a more conventional reason. She missed her ex-boyfriend. Sometimes when a guy really likes a girl, he gets a tattoo on his arm. I got this prominent scar instead. But there are times when I finger its deep groove and those 6 beautiful hours in the emergency room flicker in my head. Then I am reminded how close I am to an alternate world in which I am happy. A world that occupies the same space as this one, but is somehow distinct from it. And while that better world may be difficult to find, it is as close to me as the air in front of my face.
Director Judd Apatow, reading Brian Gittes' modern love piece, At the Hospital, An Interlude of Clarity. So is Brian any closer today to that alternate happy reality he longed for in his piece? Well, I spoke with him and the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, Daniel Jones. So, Brian, my first question that just I have to ask you is, you make yourself pretty vulnerable in this column here, verging on admitting to some humiliation, maybe. But what made you want to share it with all of those readers of the New York Times?
Most of the time that I was working on it, I didn't think about anyone reading it at all. A friend kind of gave me the idea to write it, but I think when he suggested it, he was half joking and I was kind of half jokingly writing it. I honestly didn't think it was going to get picked. So I didn't have a lot of time to think about what it would be like to have lots and lots and lots of people read it.
So, Dan, in that case, why did you pick it?
Well, it's funny because, I like when I hear that someone says, I wrote it thinking no one would read it, because that's the sign of someone who is going deep and telling the truth and not trying to hide, I guess. And what I loved about this piece, it speaks to what so many people go through on a first date, trying to get to know somebody. And, you want to put your best foot forward and you want to not be vulnerable. And that just runs counter to what getting to know someone is all about. You have to be vulnerable. But what's funny about Brian's piece is he is forced into that vulnerability.
In the most literal way.
By falling onto a wine glass and being whisked to the hospital.
There was something about the way that you ended the column, Brian, that's really stuck with me, because you're talking about this alternative existence where you could feel happiness that's not quite there with you all the time, but it's there just in front of your face. I mean, do you still feel that way?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I don't think it wasn't an experience that sort of magically fixed all the problems I have with anxiety and that sort of thing. I mean, that's kind of an ongoing struggle, but it is a sort of touchstone, I guess, I can refer back to now as a point of reference, like a psychological and even spiritual point of reference.
Now you know what's possible in a way. It's not that you right. have to cut open your arm every time to make it happen, but the sense that it is there and that sort of deep connection or just being real with someone and vulnerable with someone is there close. And I like that sort of realization at the end.
Brian, Judd Apatow narrated your story for us, and we actually also asked him why he chose this one. And here's what he said.
I think I was attracted to this essay because this is how I felt on dates. I really did think that every date was going to say they had to go to the bathroom and then climb out the window. And everything bad happened to me other than almost slicing open an artery. But there's still time for that.
And hopefully that's not going to happen to him.
That's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a universality in feeling vulnerable.
And it's almost a rock bottom scenario in this one. Where what could be worse than being naked, completely naked, and about, on death's door with your blood loss?
I mean, actually, I'm curious, did the woman in the story, did she know that her experience with you in the emergency room was going to appear in the New York Times?
No, I mean, not until it was in the New York Times. She actually really liked the piece a lot, and then we ended up meeting up for a drink just to talk about it. And then weirdly, we sort of ended up going on a couple more dates, and then it kind of fizzled out again for good.
Hmm. Now, given that you were talking about how that date wasn't the first time you'd ended up in the emergency room, has it happened since then too?
Be honest.
I met someone who I've been seeing about 6 months, and we actually ended up in the ER about 3 weeks ago. I was going to cook dinner for her at my apartment, and I had just been grocery shopping, and somehow, as I was taking the bag of groceries off my shoulder, I managed to dislocate my right thumb. So much less life-threatening.
So another bonding experience?
Yeah, this was a very positive one, though.
And let's hope that you stay out of the ER as you progress further through life.
Believe me, I'll do my best.
Well, Brian Giddes is the author of this week's story titled At the Hospital, An Interlude of Clarity. He's also the assistant director of publicity at a Manhattan book publisher. Brian, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
And Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, is also author of Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Dan, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And that's the conclusion of an episode of the Modern Love podcast that first ran last year. It features director Judd Apatow, who read Brian Giddes' essay for us. WBUR produces the Modern Love podcast along with the New York Times. And if you haven't already, wherever you get your podcast, subscribe to Modern Love. Hey, subscribe to Radio Boston while you're doing it as well. But you can find a lot more information about the Modern Love podcast at wbur.org/modernlove. Now, as a reminder, we were supposed to have Judd Apatow live with us in the studio this afternoon, but his flight from New York was canceled, so he's coming up from New York City driving right now. But I'm assured that he will make it to Boston on time because he's got a couple of performances at the Wilbur Theater tonight at 7:30 and 10 p.m. And part of the proceeds from his stand-up performances will go to benefit the Greater Boston After School Arts Fund. Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.